Welcome back to The Film Experience. I'm your host, Nathaniel R. Today on the podcast, it's our special companion edition of To the Smackdown. We want to thank Stinky Lulu for the original inspiration. Basically, what the Smackdown is, if you're new, is we look back at previous Oscar races. We get a panel together to rewatch the films or watch them for the first time and discuss them. You've already read our short capsule reviews on these performances, and now we'll have more time to go into detail on the films themselves and our histories with these movies and actresses. So today we're discussing the supporting actress nominees of 1973, Linda Blair from The Exorcist, Candy Clark from American Graffiti, Madeline Kahn and Tatum O'Neill from Paper Moon, and Sylvia Sidney from Summer Wishes, Winter Dreams. So without further ado, let's meet our panelists. So I'm here with my special guests, Dana Delaney.
Good morning.
And it's very exciting to have you here. You're an award-winning actor, and we're talking about awards. So that's great. We also have Bill Chambers from Film Freak Central.
Hello.
Mark Harris, an editor-at-large at Entertainment Weekly.
Hey, everyone.
And I'm sure you've read Mark's Oscar book, Pictures at a Revolution, which is, like, the best. And he's got a new book out, Five Came Back, so you should read that, too. Karina Longworth, she's the creator-host of You Must Remember This.
Hi.
And Karina, I hope this Smackdown has inspired an episode of some sort for your fine podcast.
Yeah, maybe I'll introduce the world to Summer Wishes, Winter Dreams.
And Kyle Turner, he writes for The Movie Scene and a lot of places, actually.
Howdy there.
Had you all seen these movies before?
This is Dana. Everything except Summer Wishes, Winter Dreams.
Okay.
Same. This is Kyle. That's the same. And it took... I couldn't find Summer Wishes, Winter Dreams for a really long time.
Yeah.
Amazon!
Right.
I'm broke. I'm a broke college student.
I would have shared mine with you.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
Yeah, I figured that would be the one that was difficult. But otherwise, people were familiar, I assume. We had lucked out to have a lot of classic films this time. I wanted to start with American Graffiti. It's very much a boy movie. And I know, for example, Dana, you mentioned that you didn't like the postscript of the movie.
No, I didn't. They didn't mention any of the women and what happened to them. Obviously, they all just got married.
Well, I mean, do you think Debbie would have gotten married, given Candy Clark's performance?
I think she would have gotten married several times.
Eat, drink, and remarry.
Now, with her performance, Dana and I were the biggest fans of it.
Yes.
The interesting thing about the Smackdown is trying to decide how to judge a performance. And the reason I was so taken with this one, I felt like there was no character for her to play based on the script.
Oh, absolutely not.
No. And so I thought, well, she's creating this from whole cloth. And Bill, I loved your comment about a fembot awaiting an activation key, Colin Stevens. Because she totally switches in her introductory scene. And it just feels like everything about that part is the actress rather than the part.
I feel like that's why my grade was maybe slightly lower. It was not a reflection on her performance at all. But the movie, as Dana said, does not imagine women from the inside at all. It just doesn't know how to do that. And so everything that's cool and quirky and real about that character is something she brings to it. It doesn't seem to me that it's on the page at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It was written very much, I thought, as a cliche, you know, blonde bombshell, which also was Suzanne Summers' character in many ways, which I'd forgotten. She didn't even have any lines. That part. Right.
Maybe she's possibly more emblematic of the movie.
Yeah.
Candy Clark.
But Candy just brought her own little zhuzh to it, you know? And she's just kind of a wacky actress who just seems game for anything. So I just appreciated that.
You know, I think that that postscript where you see on screen what happened to each of the male characters is specifically the movie that they were making fun of 5 years later in Animal House, where you get comic postscripts and, you know, one guy is fragged by his own troops in Vietnam and all that.
Mm-hmm. Right. Right.
Yeah. What surprised me about Candy Clark's nomination was that it's not as loud, I guess, as the other performances. It's significantly more subtle, and I'm a little surprised that the Academy didn't nominate someone like Mackenzie Phillips, who's very, very overt and in your face about her being kind of a tween, a twerp.
Well, I think they were probably overloaded on youth in this particular year.
Yeah.
Both Mark and Karina, you both know a lot about Oscar history, and you both mentioned what the Academy tends to be drawn to, and that I think that's very true. Do you think when they do that, Karina, do you think when they are drawn to the starlets who are bringing the sort of sexy and sad, as you mentioned, do you think they have any concern or thought for, is this person's career going to bloom from here? Or do you think they just, that type, they just can't resist?
Well, you know, the funny thing about the Academy is, like, you can totally nail them for doing the same thing over and over again, but it's also an evolving body, and so it's hard to psychoanalyze them. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I do think that you see often this impulse to acknowledge that somebody has had a breakout performance and then give them this boost of the nomination with the idea that this is going to be the beginning of a career. But, I mean, I think this category is interesting because you have a lot of young performers where this is kind of the big movie that they did. Mm-hmm. And their attempts to kind of, I mean, Tatum O'Neill has, you know, maybe four or five, and Linda Blair certainly tried. but, like, these are the landmark films in their careers.
Mm-hmm. I don't believe that anyone actually withholds votes because they think, well, I'm not sure this vote is a good investment for the future of this person. I mean, I think, you know, of a much more recent year when Rinko Kikuchi and Adriana Barraza were both nominated for Best Supporting Actress for Babel. And I don't think anyone was thinking, oh, but what if this is the only time I get to nominate them? I think when push comes to shove, if they like the performance, that's more decisive. Mm-hmm.
I think that's a great point. And one of the readers' comments was, strong within limits is still limited, which I think is very astute about this performance, because there's just not a lot for her to do. But I'm wondering, overall on the film, I had not actually seen this film until this year when we used this film for an episode of my series, Hit Me With Your Best Shot. And I had heard that the cinematography was very, at the time, very celebrated. I know, Dana, you said you don't think the movie holds up well, but I was wondering, had anybody seen it before? Did it feel a lot different this time?
It felt different to me. Everyone remembers it as a kind of nostalgia piece, but I was surprised at what an indie it felt like. It's all shot at night. It's very small scale, and it's not so much the kind of nostalgia that led to Happy Days as it is people are already feeling sad within the movie that this life that they had is going away. Mm-hmm. So almost a little more about nostalgia than I had recalled.
I felt nostalgic watching the movie. Because, you know, I was in high school when I saw this movie, so that was, you know, my era. And I was amazed how many people were in it that went on to have amazing careers. You know, it really just kind of started off a bunch of people. And I remember my junior prom that year, we did the American Graffiti prom. You know, everybody wanted to be back in the 50s then. That's when everybody was doing the hop, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then later in the 70s, we get Grease. So there was a lot of nostalgia for the 50s.
It's sort of like what the 80s are now, really.
Mm-hmm.
We're always 20 or 30 years behind.
Yep. Yeah.
Although it's so weird that that movie was made only 11 years after it set. It would be like us making a huge nostalgia movie now about 2003. I don't know.
That hasn't been done yet? I'm kind of surprised.
Well, at the rate the internet goes, we will start seeing that. Everything feels old within a month. Now, I was wondering what you all thought of George Lucas from here. Karina, you had mentioned that you felt the actors were adrift for his lack of direction, and obviously later in his career, it gets worse, I think.
Yeah.
Can you expound on that? What did you see in that made you make that comment?
Well, I read a book about George Lucas a few years ago, and so I've studied his movies, and that it's something that's really noticeable. And I know that he's really always been more interested in sort of the superficial element, not superficial in terms of, you know, sort of cheap, but the visual elements of films. He's interested in machines and things like lighting and camera. And if he could, he never would have had humans in his movies. And he's kind of moved towards that towards the end. Even just basic, I mean, Dana and all of you were talking about how these female characters sort of, like, he doesn't even really try to get into their heads or make them important. But I think some of the male characters are kind of cliches as well. I think if you look at all of his movies, one of the things that it's almost not even a fault. It's just what he does. He's interested in archetypes and sort of the classic stories, mm-hmm. and then bringing in new technology and sort of new ways of making these old stories cinematic.
Yeah.
Wasn't that sort of the feel of Zoetrope back then? They all were kind of under that spell, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, one thing you can say about this movie that isn't like his other movies is that he may not explore the characters deeply, but he at least does give the actors room to do a little within those archetypes. I mean, they're not all complete tools of his overall scheme, the way they might be in his more elaborate movies. When I know Harrison Ford used to say that the only direction he ever got from George Lucas was faster.
Yes. And more intense.
Faster and more intense, that's right.
Yeah. I've heard Carrie Fisher say something similar.
But I agree about him giving the room to the actors in this. I feel like they all kind of got to play, and, you know, some were more successful at it than others. But there was some, I mean, just Richard Dreyfuss's little smile through the whole thing. There was a whole inner life going on there.
Yeah, he had a good decade in the 70s.
Yeah.
I do have a question as I was thinking of how it kind of felt panoramic in terms of how it goes from character to character. And I thought of a good double feature would be this and Dazed and Confused, although Dazed and Confused might be a slightly better film in its ability to investigate a little bit more intimacy between the characters.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's a great idea.
Yeah. I like that idea. It's like doing a food and wine pairing for movies, you know. But Dazed and Confused is a great follow for this. Mm-hmm.
One thing that I learned when I was sort of researching the making of this movie a few years ago that I had never really realized before was that Lucas was really influenced by documentaries. Mm-hmm. And that this editing pattern of interweaving the stories was really unusual for a narrative film at that time.
Huh. Oh.
Yeah, because now it just seems de rigueur. Like, if you have multiple storylines, you just cross-cut back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
So Summer Wishes, Winter Dreams was the hardest film to find. It's out of print, so it's only, you know, previous copies. And as I was watching it, I was thinking, Joanne Woodward, like, a lot of her filmography seems to be these contemporary psychoanalytic type of films, from Three Faces of Eve and Rachel, which I actually love. And this is very much that again, with all about Joanne Woodward's psyche. So there wasn't a lot of room for Sylvia Sidney. But this was a divisive performance within the panel. And I know, Dana, you did not respond to it at all.
Yeah, I think I just had a personal reaction to it. I mean, I think it was Mark who said he knows women like this. And I do too. And I think that's what bothered me so much. I mean, I really felt like I was watching my mother. And my mother is that character from a farm in Connecticut and then a New York person. And I don't know, but it wasn't so much the character as I felt like, as an actor, I felt like Sylvia Sidney, I mean, God bless her, but I just felt like she was like, I'm in a movie now, so I got to perform. And I haven't been in a movie in a while. And I just felt like it was a real performance as opposed to actually listening to each other. And you know, and I know the whole point was they didn't listen to each other, and the dialogue didn't help. It just felt like way too much for me and abrasive, and I don't know. It just bugged me.
I mean, I certainly agree with abrasive. But, you know, I had an aunt who, when she was dying of lung cancer, said, well, at least I won't have to wait online at the Metropolitan Opera anymore.
Right. Yeah.
You know, she was exactly like that. You know, everyone on the panel was so nice about these movies, except when we got to this one, and I felt like we all went in hoping that this was going to be some little 70s gem, and everyone was like, oh, crap. No, this is not fun. And I guess I rated her more highly because she does kind of, for all the bigness, and I agree, I think Dana said she goes large in the movie. It's a large, noisy performance, but I love the voltage that's going through her 20 minutes as opposed to what happens afterward, which is this kind of very mopey, you know. I would recommend for everybody to get the DVD just so you can see the original poster, which is Joanne Woodward in a fur coat, and the slogan is beautiful. Frigid. She is called a snow queen.
Yeah, it's quite the tagline.
And it's like a sepia watercolor or something.
Yes,
right.
An image.
Yeah.
Oh my god, the opening scene alone on the plane. Ugh.
I did not think I was watching the right film when it began that way. I was like, is this right? Someone done me the wrong thing?
Now, Bill, I loved your comment about Rita's mother, actual billing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, she doesn't even get a name in this.
So I was wondering, Dana, when you know, because I'm sure every actor has had parts like that where the part is just based on how it informs another part.
Yeah.
So do you think Sylvia Sidney had it all mapped out, what that character's name was, things before it at the movie?
I think so, and I probably would have been, I would have given the same performance, I think, if I had been given that part, which kind of bugs me too. I don't know, I mean, Sylvia Sidney's from a different era of acting, and it kind of felt that way. You know, Joanne Woodward was very psychological, Freudian kind of thing, and I guess that was the point, they're from different generations, but the whole lemon thing, you know, the whole, they slice them in London, mm-hmm.
I love, though, that, I mean, you're exactly right. Joanne Woodward, it's all psychological, and she gave, like, five or six performances probably between, you know, Rachel and this and the effect of gamma rays on Man in the Moon Marigold. She was always like, what is the most unflattering possible integrity of this character? And I feel like Sylvia Sidney came in and thought, like, what can I do with this crap?
Yeah, probably right.
Maybe, like, in this case, that was a fairer read of the material.
Yeah, I think, I mean, my favorite moment is her face when she looks at the picture of the sun, the gay sun, and gives that face, that sour face, which is so something my mother would do, and that just cracked me up.
Right.
Yeah, I did think, I mean, I know nobody really liked the movie, but I actually love watching movies that feel like time capsules that aren't meant as time capsules or nostalgia.
Yeah.
Because it did, like, the psychology of it did feel extremely, like, mired in that time, and I thought the gay content was fascinating.
The ballet dancer.
Yeah.
God.
Who appears courtesy of the Joffrey Ballet, by the way, if you read the closing credits.
Oh, wow.
And the son ended up being a comedy writer, which I thought was fascinating. I looked everybody up. I became obsessed with the film.
No. I like that there was wild strawberries in it.
Yeah.
Oh, I was going to say, that's another thing I was going to say about it being a time capsule. When New Yorkers were obsessed with Ingmar Bergman, like, I was thinking, I bet you anything people joked about falling asleep and dying during Bergman films when this came out. And now it's all lost in time, unless we look up. There were no blogs back then to hear all these comments.
I will say I really liked her death scene. I didn't get a chance to write much about that, but it's a very horrific, sort of unsentimental death scene.
I absolutely agree. And I love that she insults Rita during it.
Yes.
She's still in character. Bill, I also love that you brought up Beetlejuice, because it's so funny how everyone thinks of Beetlejuice with Sylvia Sidney, even though she had this long career.
And 30-something. She was in 30-something, too.
Was she?
Yep.
I love the fact that she, you know, she has this, it's her big comeback. She hadn't made a feature film in more than 10 years. She has this gruesome heart attack, you know, 20 minutes into it. And then she lived for like 8,000 more years. This whole long, amazing sort of, she was a busy actress after that.
Yeah. Yeah, so sometimes the nomination does give you a boost.
Right.
We'll move on to Paper Moon and The Exorcist, and the natural place to start here is a very young category. I don't know, like, offhand, if this is the only year with, like, two preteens in it. Linda Blair is, well, actually, she was a teenager, but she was playing a preteen. And I know, Dana, you in particular, because we've talked about this offline, you have very strong feelings about child actors.
Yeah, I'm not in favor.
So, but you gave Tatum a very high rating. And
I thought she was terrific. I just worry about her. You know, I mean, look at her life after that. I just, it's rare. It's so rare that a child who has acted young goes on to be a happy human being. And I just think it's not fair to them at
all. But you had mentioned creating a safe set. What do you think contributes to how good Linda and or Tatum are?
Well, you know, I wasn't there, but I can only imagine that Ryan had a lot to do with Tatum's performance, you know, because she was so comfortable and expressive. And I think, like a few people said, it wasn't just being the tough little girl. There were moments of great tenderness and vulnerability, too. Mm-hmm. But you had to be really relaxed and comfortable to do that. So she obviously felt free with Bogdanovich. I'm not sure about Linda Blair, whether she was terrified into that performance or what.
Yeah.
I don't know, but she certainly gave it her all.
Yeah. I know, Mark, you also are on record of having some issues with the way Oscar deals with child actors.
Yeah, I had issues with the Cuvenzhané Wallace nomination, because I think that below a certain age you are almost always dealing with a directorial achievement at least as much as an acting achievement. Like, yeah. I don't think it's six. I don't think it's fair to judge that as a sort of considered performance where an actress is making choices. But that said, you know, I really loved Tatum O'Neill in Paper Moon, and I did watch it, coming back to it after all these years, I watched it, I think, with sort of skeptical eyes in terms of her performance. I wanted to see, like, okay, how manipulated does this feel? And obviously, yes, Ryan O'Neill and Peter Bogdanovich should get great credit, but there are these lovely scenes where, you know, that scene where she's in front of the mirror trying on her mother's poses, you know, there are a lot of long takes of her. It's not just this thing, this performance that was assembled out of bits and pieces. It's real acting. So I was really quite taken with it. I think it holds up very, very well as acting.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I agree.
Yeah, and I mean, it's a fascinating comparison since they're so easy to compare because they were both very young for Oscar. But Linda Blair's performance, it is the opposite. Even if you like it, which I know, like Kyle, you were the most fond of it.
I'm surprised I was the only one who liked it.
But it is, even if you love it, it is assembled from many parts, whereas Tatum is just sort of the cameras on her. And Linda Blair's is, I was wondering, was it really hard to judge? Did you, as you were watching The Exorcist, were you like checking off marks? Okay, that part was Linda.
It was difficult for me. I hadn't seen the movie since I was a teenager, and I'm pretty sure the last time I saw it, I was, like, very stoned. And, you know, it used to be the kind of movie that I would watch as a teenager as, like, wow, check this out, you know? And so this was the first time I was watching it as a serious movie, and I found it very difficult to take seriously. Mm-hmm. But actually watching her performance, it was very difficult for me to separate out what that young actress is doing, what is makeup, what is the way in which she's being lighted and framed, what is the dubbed-in voice.
Also, she had a stand-in named Eileen Dietz, who did a lot of stuff. I just read her memoir, actually.
Stand-in has a memoir?
Yeah,
oh, my God.
A lot of the ethically dubious kind of stuff that she wound up doing.
Oh, that's interesting, because I was thinking if it was made today, it would be much more sexualized. You know, it was actually quite tame, except for her words.
Well, Friedkin apparently basically met her for lunch just before the Oscars because an article had come out about her, and basically told her she'd never eat lunch in this town again, and he was right.
What, because she voiced that she had done some of it?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I mean, I know that I had read that the famous crucifix in the crotch scene, it's shot the way it is because Linda was not the one making that motion. You know, 'cause you see her from her back.
No, okay. See, she did not deserve that nomination. I take it back.
I will say, though, that I don't, whatever her deficiencies as an actress are, and I think, you know, in her one dialogue scene where she talks about, you know, a pony or something, you sort of see that she's just this ordinary kid, not really a special actress. I don't think it particularly hurt the scheme of the movie. Like, I don't think having a really great child actress in that part would have necessarily made for a better movie. She's supposed to be this ordinary little girl who is seized by this demon. And for me, her kind of blandness and her ordinariness didn't detract from, maybe even added to, the approach the movie was taking. Now, like, you can absolutely say, okay, but she didn't deserve an Oscar nomination for that. But it didn't, I didn't feel it hurt the movie at all.
I think that both this and Candy Clark, you might have a little bit of a thing where it's like, when you're trying to figure out like why they got nominated versus somebody else, both of these movies were things that became cultural phenomena.
Yeah.
And the Academy sometimes likes to prove that they're like hip with the zeitgeist.
Yeah.
By acknowledging performances in movies like that.
How about those MRI machines? I said to Nathaniel, that scared me more than anything else in the movie.
Yeah, the medical equipment was
Oh my God,
terrifying.
That was scary.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. I, you know, Karina, you obviously do not like The Exorcist, which I thought was interesting because I've seen it a few times for various, because it is such a landmark film. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure that I think it's great, but I think I just love it so much because in comparison to what we see now that constitutes horror, I love just how it's centered on character and it just goes off on all these weird tangents and they give so much time to all the people.
Yeah, they give a lot of time to a lot of things. It's really long. I don't know. It used to be something, you know, 20 years ago, it was something that I would watch to laugh at. And maybe that means that I can never really take it seriously. But I really tried, you know, this time when I was watching it. And I just think every performance is terrible. I think the movie's idea of evil is laughable. I don't think that it really takes any of its ideas seriously. And I know that's an unpopular opinion, but I really, really, really don't like it.
I was scared by it then and now. I have to admit, I feel like the sort of straight-faced way in which it takes itself very seriously is something that I wish makers of contemporary horror films would grab onto a little bit. There's nothing very winking about the movie. And also, the stakes are pretty low. All of the action, the big action, takes place in this upstairs bedroom in this, you know, nice Georgetown house. I always think, like, so Ellen Burstyn is downstairs having coffee during that climax. She's just, like, waiting for these people to take care of this thing so that she can get back to making her movie.
Yeah, she's more of a supporting actress than Tatum O'Neill.
I kind of love that, though.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, horror is like porn, I guess. You know, it either works for you or it doesn't. You know, you can't say to someone, but it was scary. It's like, you're scared or you're not scared.
Yeah.
Which version did we watch? I watched the extended cut.
Me too.
I watched the original.
I watched the original, too.
I hope I watched the original, but I'm never sure because I get confused about which parts belong to which versions.
Yeah, I just watched whatever was on Netflix.
Mm-hmm. Well, if it had the cool spider walk down the stairs or up the stairs,
it had that, yeah.
That's the extended version.
Oh, so that's what I watched as well. So, Karina, you had to suffer through even more of it. One comment I did really want to talk about, because I think it's relevant to the now as well, is, Bill, you had, you know, you were talking about Linda Blair providing the base coat, and then you said in the end it's not unlike nominating Yoda, which is really funny. But it also reminds me of the whole controversy now about Andy Serkis and Dawn of the Planet of the Apes and these collaborative performances.
Right. Well, eventually they're going to have to find a way to address that. I don't know what the solution is, but
I know Mark and I are both on the same page with this, that if they really must, why not a honorary for someone, or a special Oscar, which they used to do for visual effects type of thing.
That includes the actor. I'd be fine with that.
Mm-hmm. And because in a way, like the, you know, Pazuzu, the demon in this movie, is extremely, whatever you think of the movie absolutely wouldn't work without that.
It's a singular achievement. I mean,
right, but it's all those things. It's the makeup artist, it's Mercedes McCambridge, it's Linda Blair. So maybe if the nomination could have included those other people as well. That's always a tricky part for me dealing with the Oscars, is who gets credit for what. And one of the things I like to bring up, because it just angers me to this day, is Charlize Theron and Monster, and the makeup artists were not nominated.
Wow.
And people, and that makeup is so, it looks so convincing.
Yeah.
And people kept saying, oh, she's so transformative. She made herself so, you know, unattractive. And I'm like, but the makeup artist did so much work. So, I mean, I'm not knocking the performance, but it just seems like people get credit for strange things.
But then at what point do you start crediting the editor and what, you know,
Sure, it's a slippery slope. Yeah.
Yeah.
I feel like the whole Andy Serkis thing is a whole another league, you know, because to me the hardest thing is he's actually on set, you know, in a little leotard with all those things on him, having to act and not feel like an idiot, you know, and give a really sincere performance, which he does in that movie. It's pretty, pretty amazing. But I think that he actually should be nominated as an actor.
So you don't think collaborative is the way to go? Just view him as another actor.
I think in that movie in particular, yeah, because I think he's kind of what makes the movie work. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a great movie, period, but he really centers it.
Mm-hmm. It's such a hard apples and oranges kind of thing in a way, because I read this sort of indignant article by this one of the lead animators for one of the Lord of the Rings movies saying, no, we actually changed his performance in post. And when he made a facial expression that Peter Jackson didn't like, they'd commission a new one from me. So it's like, you know, maybe it should be an award for like best angrily collaborative. Question is, are you dealing with an astounding technological achievement in which an actor was an absolutely crucial element, or are you dealing with a great performance that is aided by astounding technology? Mm-hmm. Like, I think that's what people are still wrestling with and trying to find language to understand.
Mm-hmm. Well, going back to George Lucas, he was talking about how on Revenge of the Sith or Clones, one of those, he would take Natalie Portman's mouth from one take and put it on her face from a different take.
That's terrifying.
God.
It is.
God.
At what point, you know,
that must feel, yeah, it must feel so violating for an actor.
Absolutely. Oh my God. I don't think I'd watch the movie if I knew that.
Yeah.
I feel like David Fincher does a similar thing, because he's been known to tinker with edits very minutely and very precisely. So I would not be surprised if he does that as well.
I mean, imagine if Kubrick had access to that technology.
Yeah, well, we are just cattle.
I'm sure some readers missed the introductory post about what 1973 means to us. So for those of us who are alive in 73, I know, Mark, your story about The Exorcist, you should share again.
My story about The Exorcist, well, I wasn't allowed to go in 1973. And in fact, my older cousins told me that It was such a scary movie that Congress had passed a law saying that it could never be shown again after this initial run. It's never going to be on TV, and there was no such thing as cable, so I had just missed it. But one kid in my, you know, third or fourth grade class did see it, and he was known as, like, the kid with bad parents.
So were they telling you that just because they were trying to upset you because you wanted to see it?
Totally. I would have done anything to see The Exorcist, but that was at a time when movie theaters actually had managers and ushers, and a kid could not walk into an R-rated movie, you know, unattended. So.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Now, Dana, did you see that when it was first out?
You know, I didn't, because there was such hysteria around it, and you were hearing about people throwing up in the aisles, that I think I didn't see it until college, which was a couple of years later. It must have still been playing somewhere. And I remember seeing it going, eh, what's the big deal?
So you had more of a Karina reaction, not scary to you.
Yeah, I think, just to go back for a second, I did appreciate the 70s vibe to it, that it really was a real movie, not just a horror film as we think of them today. So I did appreciate that. Mm-hmm. And they shot in Iraq. I mean, can you imagine now doing that, or spending the money to go to Iraq? That's when Billy Friedkin said, I want to go to Iraq. And they said, okay.
Just for that one scene, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, I did find one great story, though. The New York Times did a piece about the phenomenon of the line, because in New York, people were waiting 4 hours to see the movie. So they went and waited in line and interviewed some of the people who were waiting to get into the movie about why they were waiting for so long. And they have this quote saying, you know, everybody wants to be part of something big, says Bill Hurt, 23, who sounds like a psychiatrist than the aspiring actor that he is.
Wow.
That's funny.
That's pretty great. So, yeah, it really is. It really was a cultural phenomenon, as Karina was saying. You had to have, you know, you have to know about those things. And if you're an Oscar voter, I suppose you have to take them seriously. Any other Exorcist comments?
Anybody? I watched it with my mother the first time I saw it.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I also saw Black Swan with her in theater, so we have an interesting relationship sometimes.
Yeah, you do.
Was it your idea to see it, to rent it, The Exorcist?
I think it was kind of a joint decision to some extent. I had wanted to see it, and then she kind of finally gave in and let me, because at that time I think I had a blog, and I was originally not allowed to watch rated R movies, and I think I saw The Exorcist when I was 11 or 12. Mm-hmm. And she was like, well, I can't keep the horse in the stable if he's already got a blog, so I'll watch it with him. And then she stood up in front of the television during some of the more questionable parts and blocked my view.
So basically, yeah, I was about to say, so she was one of those bad parents that Mark was talking about.
Almost.
But then she did try to protect you.
Yeah, and then that kind of just fell by the wayside as time went on.
Yeah. My first movie that I was not allowed to see that I have a conscious memory of was Grease. Because my first movie-going memories started around, like, 1976-ish. And, like, because I was really obsessed with the Witch Mountain series. That was my first movie obsession. but when Grease came out, like, everyone in school was talking about it. My parents wouldn't let me go because I think it was PG or something. Mm-hmm. And they were like, you can't see it. And so that was my first time having that experience of the parents, you know, putting their foot down.
That's such a dirty film, but I was allowed to watch that when I was five.
Grease. But because I didn't have the desire to see the scary ones like Mark did. Like, I do remember when Jaws came out, and I did a little comic strip for the blog once about it, because my brothers in our swimming pool used to swim under the water and attack me because I was so scared of Jaws because I had seen the poster, and people were always talking about it. So every time I got in the pool, I was looking to see if anything was in the pool. So these 70s horror things.
I snuck out of school and snuck into Bonnie and Clyde, which was very racy.
Yeah.
Very racy. Yeah. And no, I think it was rated Was it R or A? It was R, right?
I think it was before the ratings.
That's what it was, yes. But I skipped school that day and then went with my girlfriend. And I remember thinking, this is way over my head. Mm-hmm. Way too adult for me. What is his problem in bed? I don't understand.
I felt that way about Carrie.
Like, yeah.
I went to see Carrie, and I thought, I do not belong in this locker room.
So I want to ask a couple questions related to, we'll get to Paper Moon in a second, but a couple questions related to your past work, Mark, since you wrote a whole entire book on one specific Oscar category here, which of these movies do you think would make the most fascinating book if someone were to write about the making
of the four movies in this category?
Yeah.
Oh, definitely The Exorcist. I mean, just because there was so much craziness around the book, and the Catholic Church got involved, and it really was this immense cultural phenomenon that made its way onto like the editorial pages, and mm-hmm. You know, some small towns tried to ban it, and some churches really embraced it because they thought, you know, it made the Catholic Church look powerful. And I think there's so much there was so much kind of 70s craziness around Friedkin and you know, interesting things that foreshadowed things to come, as we've discussed about the way Linda Blair's performance was created, that I think if we were doing a book, that'd be a pretty good movie to focus on.
Mm-hmm. How about you, Karina? What would you, for your You Must Remember This podcast that tells old forgotten stories about Hollywood and movies, which of these things we watch do you think would make the best episode of that?
I think I would actually be more interested in talking about Paper Moon. Because first of all, one of the things that is a driving factor for me in terms of choosing topics is just wanting to read about things that I don't know the whole story about. And so I don't really know much about the working relationship between Bogdanovich and Ryan O'Neill and Tatum O'Neill on that film. I do know that the famous story of how Bogdanovich begged Polly Platt, who was sort of his estranged wife, to come work on the movie as a production designer, and she insisted that his new girlfriend, Sybil Shepherd, be banned from the set. And so that kind of thing is just fascinating to me. And I have actually I've been doing this series on the many loves of Howard Hughes, and I really want to do a series on the many loves of Peter Bogdanovich. But it's a little scary because he's alive. But,
right.
That would be interesting for me. And
how much prep work do you have to do on each of those episodes?
Well, I've been doing this thing over the past 2 months where I've been trying to make an episode a week. And so that's... It's difficult because I'm often reading like two or three books in the course of like two or three days in order to do it. Mm-hmm. But it's a lot easier if I can take like 2 weeks, because then I can basically spend a week doing research and writing. Mm-hmm. But I do a ton of research. You know, I read basically as many sort of biographical things as I can find. And I'm in San Francisco for the summer, but usually back in Los Angeles. I go to the Margaret Herrick Library, the Academy's library, and they have these great clippings files where you can just give them the name of a person or the name of a film, and they'll give you magazine clippings and microfiche, just, you know, dating back as far as that person has been active. And it's just, I really like reading magazine articles that were written in the time when something happened, not because it's necessarily more truthful, but because you get a sense of how something or somebody was perceived in the moment.
Yeah, and that in the moment thing is so crucial to awards, you know, campaign. One of the reasons we do the SmackDown is because when you look back at something, all the politics have fallen away, mm-hmm. And all the sort of hype of the moment, and it's more interesting to sort of pick things apart and, you know, you're conscious that that might have happened, but it's not there. Informing you so much. But Dana, since you've actually been up for awards, I'm wondering how that feels from the inside. I know it's not the Oscars, but it's similar. It's the, you know, it's the TV Oscars, essentially.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you feel that sort of outside of the work feeling when you're in those situations?
Well, they are different in the sense that usually for television, you're still working while you're doing it. You know, you're still on whatever you're doing if it's a series.
Right, and you're still playing the same character, yeah.
Right, so you don't really have time. There's not all the hoopla. Plus, I won awards many years ago. And it wasn't the thing that it is now. You know, it's just ridiculous, the machine now. Mm-hmm. Of the parties and the, you know, the wooing people and all that stuff. It's such a business. I mean, you guys would know better than me because you write about it. But I don't know when that all started. But I know in terms of television, that started recently, like the last 10 years. Because mm-hmm. when I won my Emmys, Sylvia Sidney, when I won my Emmys, you know, I went and bought my own dress in the store. There was no such thing as a stylist back then.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's really gotten, I think, just, it's kind of, it's not about the work, and I can see why certain, you know, talent, directors, writers, actors, they all just kind of throw their hands up at it and don't want anything to do with it, too. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Since we're talking about awards, hoopla, so now we arrive at the winner, which was Tatum O'Neill and Paper Moon, a film we had two nominees. Now, two nominees from the same film is very common, actually, in supporting actress, as fans of the Oscars know. And I think it was really difficult for all of us to judge these two performances in the same breath, because they're so... Yeah. They serve such different functions. And as Dana, as you said, it's instinct versus craft.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you just... I mean, they work great together, the two of them. But like we all mentioned, that one scene when Madeline Kahn is walking up the hill, mm-hmm. you know, it all just comes together... the sassiness and the brass and then mm-hmm. the intelligence and the desperation and all of that. And then I don't know if you guys read this, but I was curious and I read that she didn't want to say the word tits. It really bothered her. And I guess Bogdanovich convinced her to do it in one take. She would only say that word in one take. And of course, that's the one they used.
And it's a single take too. I mean, it's a continuous shot.
Yeah, she thought well. She thought it lacked class.
Now, Dana, you actually met her.
I did. I met her in the 80s, and she was just the most wonderful, down-to-earth human being. You know, and she was already a big star then, and she just was great. You wonder if she had survived what she would be doing now, you know? Uh-huh. Where would that talent have taken her? I just think it was such a loss that she died so young.
Yeah.
Yeah, and... I mean, for me, it wasn't a big kind of who's better, Madeline Kahn or Tatum O'Neill moment. I really loved watching the movie again and both performances. But for Madeline Kahn, it was just one of those moments where I thought, you know, no one else would have done it this way. You know, what was unique about her not just her comic timing, but her ability to kind of really intelligently have that character thinking and feeling more than one thing at once. And mm-hmm. and so you watch her in that big negotiation, you know, trying to get something out of this kid and trying not to look desperate and needy and frightened. And for me, it suddenly reminds you in this really profound way that the Depression was not a fairy tale, that someone like Trixie was, you know, doing everything she could to survive and make it. And, mm-hmm. you know, so even though, yeah, you are technically rooting against her in the overall scheme of the movie, I was stunned by how quickly and how effectively she created this really poignant, heartbreaking, very funny character.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, now your comment about that, about the Depression, was really interesting to me because it got me thinking about how the Depression was actually like a fairly common topic. Like, you don't see movies made about it now that much. But in the late 60s and early 70s, it was, you know, Bonnie and Clyde, They Shoot Horses, mm-hmm. Don't They, Paper Moon. It was, like, much more present in people's minds.
Well, the country was in economic depression then, so yeah. It makes sense.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, since last year there were, I think, 5 or 6 films made kind of about the decay of the American dream, and I'm wondering if any of those will become as lasting as the films that you mentioned.
Like what ones are you talking about?
Pain and Gain, Spring Breakers, The Wolf of Wall Street, American Hustle.
Right, which was also like looking back.
Yeah.
I'd forgotten how great Alvin Sargent's script was. That is a good script.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's unsentimental.
And so concise. Yeah. Like, that movie is just, it knows exactly what it wants to do, and it just does it without any, without embellishments, you know? It just gets right to the core of every scene.
Yeah, I mean, these days you'd have some heartfelt moment at the end between father and daughter, you know, where they hug or something.
Right.
And it doesn't happen, and I love that. Mm-hmm.
Well, the people in charge of making movies in the 70s largely grew up in the 30s. So the relationship of 70s movies to the Depression is sort of like the relationship of movies now to the 70s and early 80s. There's firsthand knowledge and experience going into those movies. And I think that's one of the reasons that Paper Moon really works, is that the Depression wasn't some remote historical time to the people involved any more than it was to, you know, Arthur Penn for Bonnie and Clyde. He grew up in the Depression.
Mm-hmm. And really good clothes, too. Fantastic.
So, Karina, I thought one of your comments was about that you thought Madeline Kahn's performance was most interesting for what it showed us about Tatum's performance.
Well, certainly, narratively, I think that if I really love this movie and I think it's virtually perfect, but if it has a weakness, it's that when the Madeline Kahn subplot is over, mm-hmm. it sort of feels like it was a device to take you to the place where Tatum needs to get to.
Okay.
And so I do think that my sort of final impression of the film is that Tatum's performance gets better because of what Madeline Kahn gives her, which mm-hmm. is, it's not a bad thing necessarily, but it still points back to Tatum being mm-hmm. awesome.
Right.
You know?
But I mean, all the best supporting performances, that's essentially what they do.
Right.
Which is why I always get angry about category fraud, because it's a different, you know, your purpose is different as an actor. That's why I really want them to think about that when they put leading performances into supporting. It's just not fair, you know? Mm-hmm. It's like different, it's not different skill set so much as different blob of paint on the palette, you know?
Yeah, but sometimes you have supporting actors that are just scene stealers. Mm-hmm. You know, and they're not really supporting anybody.
Yeah, that's true.
They're just kind of grabbing their time while they have it.
Yeah.
Can we give a moment of praise to a third actress in that movie, PJ Johnson?
Oh, yeah. That's amazing.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, she is. Yeah.
What happened to her?
I looked her up because I was chasing that the way you were, you know, looking up Summer Wishes, Winter Dreams. And
yeah.
I don't think she ever acted again.
Amazing. Huh. It was such an odd performance. It was great.
Any last thoughts on Paper Moon?
I would like to have a child just so that I can con people with them.
That's a good reason. That's a good reason to bring a new life into the world.
Could you ever figure out how the $10 trick worked, Kyle?
Sort of. I had to Google it and kind of write it out, because I've watched this film 5 or 6 times. It's one of my favorites. And it's just very hard for me to understand that, because I'm one of those really bad Asians who can't do math.
Actually, I think they use the same trick in The Grifters. I think John Cusack uses that trick.
Oh, that's funny.
And when he goes into bars, when he orders drinks.
One thing that it made me realize is that, I mean, obviously Tatum O'Neal never got another, you know, Oscar nomination, didn't really have more great parts. That made me realize that it doesn't matter, you know, that it's not, these awards aren't and maybe shouldn't be about investment in the future or whether someone's going to work over the long term. It's like if the performance is great, the performance is great. And that performance after 41 years really, really holds up.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sure. Definitely. But yeah. I did find the echoes in her relationship with her father to be, that kind of give me chills, you know. The whole thing of her being jealous of the women. And I mean, I read her autobiography, so I was sort of adding to it. But, you know, I mean, she didn't have an easy childhood. And it's just the whole thing kind of it enriched it even more in my mind. Mm-hmm.
Ryan O'Neal was actually supposed to be at the screening of Paper Moon at the TCM Classic Film Fest that I went to this year, but he didn't show up. He He was not there, and it was kind of a short notice thing.
Well, he's been sick at various. I don't know how he's doing now, but yeah, he hasn't. That family's had trouble, as Dana mentioned.
Yeah. But he was really good in this. Funny.
It's definitely his best performance.
Really funny.
Yeah.
I don't know. Love story.
What's up, Doc?
What's up, Doc?
Yeah.
It made me think how elastic the definition of supporting is, watching Ryan O'Neal, because he's a lead, obviously, but in a way, he's giving a perfect supporting performance, because everything he's doing is helping to frame her and keep her in the center of the movie, and so that's like true support, you know? His performance isn't about himself.
I agree, and I think that was part of him as the father, wanting to, you know, make sure she was okay, you know, mm-hmm. and make this work. And you're right. It gave his performance such a generosity that you don't normally see with him, I think. Mm-hmm.
I have to end with the question that, since we have a real live actress on the panel, I have to know which of these parts, like if you were like, you know, obviously they're all through the age spectrum, but which of these parts as you were watching it, did you most think that would be interesting to play?
Oh, wow. I mean, obviously, I think it's the Tatum O'Neal part because it's the most lines.
So it is true that actors just count their lines.
No, I've never counted my lines. But she just gets to go on a real journey, you know, beginning to end. Although, I don't know, Trixie's pretty good, too.
I would like to see a buddy movie between possessed Linda Blair and Sylvia Sidney.
Which one had the rasp? Who could make the raspiest? Or they could both be dubbed by Mercedes McCambridge.
God, whenever I think of Mercedes McCambridge, I just think of Touch of Evil, and it's like my favorite line in a movie. I think when she says, "I want to watch." That's all I can think of when I watch The Exorcist. I want to watch.
Yeah. Thank you all for coming. I know we
Thank
have to
Nathaniel.
Wrap up. So,
thank you so much.
So,
thank you for having
me. So, Dana, thank you.
Thank you. A pleasure meeting you all online.
Any last words?
God, SmackDown, baby.
Bill, thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
We didn't hear about you much from Paper Moon. Did you also love that movie?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I
is that the winner for you?
Co-signing the sentiments, basically.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, thanks, Karina. And Kyle Turner.
Thank you so much for having me. I am just in awe of all of your work, and you are all doing things that I could only dream of doing.
And Mark Harris?
Oh, thanks so much. This was so much fun.
For all the listeners, this is a really great, we really lucked out. Compared to other SmackDowns, these are a really entertaining set of performances and movies that are really fun to talk about. So if you haven't yet seen them, do that right away. Thank you, everyone.
Bye.
Okay, bye.
Bye.